Welcome to the Shepherd's Crook Podcast. This ministry exists to provide coaching, resources, and events for pastors and church members. My name is Jared Sparks. Join me as I talk pastoral ministry, applied theology like manhood and womanhood, political theology, and cultural analysis with a little bit of hunting and fishing thrown in. I'm a husband, a father, and a pastor, and I'm here to remind you of the chief pastor and our King, Jesus. Hello and welcome back. Hope you guys are all doing well today. Looking forward to talking to a buddy of mine. I've not talked to him for a while, actually, so we're going to catch up a little bit just as we're here talking over video. But I'm talking to my good buddy, Brian. Brian, how's it going, man?
Man, so good. How are you doing, Jared?
Doing fantastic. My little one just turned two the other day. Growing up, it's crazy, man. Time really does fly, but we're just plugging along, enjoying life, and seems like you guys are doing the same.
Oh, yeah. Never a dull moment in the Sauvé household right now. Seven little people making a difference. Yeah, it's great.
Good deal. Well, we're going to talk about everything that's been going on out there. And I listened to the sermon you preached a couple weeks ago and actually got me back on Twitter. And I'll explain that here in a little bit. But other things that I'll need not mention, but it really was a helpful sermon. And I just want to hear about what's been going on. I know you've been sharing some stuff on the internet about it, but we'd love to hear. But let's go ahead and start with prayer. That's what we always do. So let's go ahead and pray. Father, just thank you for this time. I thank you for Brian and what you're doing and him and the church down in out in Ogden. And I thank you for Lexi and their kids. And Lord, just ask for blessing upon them. I thank you for the work that they're doing. And God, I just ask that you would build them up as a church. And I pray that these times of testing that they're walking through right now would serve to honor you and build their church up and build their families up, and that this would continue to bring them together as a community in a way that honors you and is good for the people. God, I pray for those that have been coming against them. I pray that they would be cut to the heart by the truth of your word and that you would do a work in the people that may even show up outside of their church building and would change hearts. I pray that people would be brought face to face with their own sin and come under conviction and that you'd do a work in their life. And we just thank you for this time. Ask for blessing upon this conversation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
All right. Well, Brian, it's been a little while since I've had you on. It's been, I think, maybe a couple of years. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I had been off the internet for quite a while. And I had heard that, there was things that are going to be some protesters out at the church after the whole Black Culture video, I think is what it was that maybe was the latest controversy. I don't know. But why don't you go ahead and just kind of bring us up to speed a little bit for those that may not know what's been going on out there of what happened 3 or 4 weeks ago now that you ended up preaching that sermon, A Test of Nerve.
Yeah, so we had just finished recording an episode of the King's Hall, Eric and I, on the murder of Irina Zarutska in Charlotte. And we were comparing the situation to South Africa and also Rhodesia, and just some of the racial policies that have been unfolding there, and how racial tensions in America were really percolating up from some of the same sorts of things, basically gay race communism, and the inevitable destruction that it brings in its wake. You know, so we saw that brutal murder, racially motivated murder. We did done the episode on it. We stepped out of the studio, and that episode's called The Girl on the Train.
Mm-hmm.
It was like 12:30, something like that. And that was when we heard that Charlie Kirk had been, at that point, just shot. We weren't sure what happened. And we all, you know, in the basement, all the NCP employees, elders of the church, kind of gathered around and just, you know, prayed and, you know, dread. We saw the video pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so brutal, just looked like, and all of us said, there's no way he's going to survive. That looked really bad.
Right.
And, you know, Charlie succumbs to his injuries. And there was just a lot in the air going on in the nation at that point, a lot of unrest. I think we forget because of Charlie Kirk, but even the murder of Irina Zarutska was, there was a lot of unrest, a lot of turmoil. People were very angry. And I've told the church often that in line with what the Apostle James tells us, that the anger of man doesn't accomplish the righteousness God requires, that anger is an emotion that, it, you know, there is such thing as righteous anger, but even righteous anger has to quickly be turned into righteous action, lest it curdle into something sinful. Mm-hmm. Or to sinful bitterness or sinful action. And so with everything blowing up at the same time, I decided, talked with the elder, said, I think I need to preach a sermon that explains a doctrine of righteous anger, of righteous hatred, as well as love for our enemies and how these things work together. Since we know in scripture and, you know, the psalmist in Psalm 139, a psalm I had set to music some years ago, so many of us in the church had it memorized, the ending of that psalm, David waxes eloquent about his hatred of the enemies of God, and he hates them perfect hatred. And this seems to be a virtuous thing. But then the Lord, you know, tells us to love our enemies and to pray for those who persecute us. And so I preached that sermon, A Time to Hate, and a kind of all at once then, the Girl on the Train episode and the Time to Hate sermon in different corners of the internet started reaching people that don't normally listen to my sermons or podcasts even.
Okay.
People were, you know, yeah, they've heard many of these things before. They weren't really offended. But then kind of at the same time, this clip about Black culture and some of the criticisms I had made of Black culture as a generalization, along with that sermon about righteous hatred, it ended up, long story short, going quite viral. And we had Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter Instagramming at me and hundreds of death threats, millions of people saw it. And then I ended up hearing we're going to have some protesters at the church. At the same time as all of this, one of our members was running for city council.
Okay.
In District 1, where our church is in Ogden. And he's been politically active in our community locally for some time. He's a businessman, owns a lot of property, you know, great, great man, veteran, combat veteran. And essentially his opponents realized that he was associated with me and with the church.
Okay.
And worked to mobilize some local Antifa and BLM and far left protesters against the church. The local Ogden political scene is very liberal, very, very liberal. Jace, who ran, actually ended up, he lost, he got about 41% of the vote, but he lost. His opponent made her announcement that she won in Spanish. So she's not even, that's how bad it is in Ogden with the local politics. So kind of all of that converged at the same time. And we had gun-toting Antifa flag-waving BLM pride flag folks out front of the church, and they've been there every week since. So they were there last Sunday, and I ended up preaching a sermon. I was really wrestling with it, like, Lord, what is this? Is this like, how do you want us to respond to this? And I was in a pastoral counseling meeting with someone. We were talking about it, and I believe it was the Spirit was just clarified, like, this is a test of nerve. This is a test of nerve for you. And so then I preached another, you know, a sermon called A Test of Nerve.
Right.
And talked about courage in this moment and why we shouldn't back down in light of these things, but that we should expect the hatred and reviling of the world. And really that the Lord is, in his kindness and his providence, allowing us to have our resolve tested. And really the big idea was, are we going to be the type of people who we talk a big game kind of out on the internet?
Right.
But then when the test shows up at your doorfront and people are yelling curses at you and you know, revile off and threatening you even bodily, as many people had, then are we going to stand or will we back down?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of that's the short version of the last two months or so.
August. How long was it? How many weeks was it between the Charlie Kirk sermon and then that sermon? Was it like 2 or 3 weeks?
And I think it was about September. When was Charlie Kirk? Was September 10th.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. All the time runs together, man. I can't remember when happens and what happened when.
I think that I preached that sermon on Charlie Kirk on, let's see, it was like September 14th or 21st.
Okay.
And then kind of at the same time, at first that sermon clips from the sermon had gone viral. And then subsequently, some of the clips from the Girl on the Train episode.
Okay, gotcha.
Began to go mega viral. And then they were each discovering the other.
Gotcha.
2 weeks later that I preached the Test of Nerve sermon.
Okay. So I listened to the Test of Nerve And of course, we were praying. We actually prayed for you guys as a church that first week that you had heard protesters. And it's funny, how do you actually hear protesters are going to come? Do they announce themselves on the internet? Do they text somebody who texts somebody else who finally ends up blowing your phone up and saying, hey, you better watch out this week? I mean, how does that even happen? But I mean, obviously it did. So we're praying for you as a church. We're, you know, talking back and forth, what's going to happen today and all that. So I wanted to hear the sermon. So I listened to it and thought you did a phenomenal job. Of course, you know, there's the book, Failure of Nerve, great book. And then the sermon title, Test of Nerve, and I'm listening. And personally, I was really challenged. I thought it was quite helpful. There's several things in there that I was challenged with. We'll get to that here in just a little bit. But I want to hear kind of how your people responded, because just trying to think through shepherding your people through this, you said some things that I think a lot of people would be thinking, that it's easier, it would just be easier to go to a church down the road that's not experiencing this. This could be a point where the enemy could come in and fracture and fissure and bring division to our church because of this pressure. And yes, maybe one family is built for this kind of pressure, but another family that just started coming 6 months ago may not be built for this pressure. And they start running through their head, well, I mean, I'm a protector, I'm a provider, and so this doesn't feel very safe. And so I think I might just go down the road, or I'm going to do home church for a little while. So what's the response been like since the sermon was preached, considering that people are in different places and maybe in different, you know, spots to be able to receive that kind of a sermon? How's it been since then?
It's been really good. I mean, we had a lot of the points of the sermon were related to conversations that I've been having with people in the church, mm-hmm. especially men, because and I mentioned it in the sermon, but there's a different thing between facing danger yourself as a man and then threats to your family,
right,
to your wife and children. And one of the tactics of the left and of the demonic left is to try to manipulate you via fear into inaction, mm-hmm. to just make action costly, especially effective opposition of their rhetoric, message, strategy. They will manipulate you into silence for fear of social rejection, like you're going to be ostracized if you don't do the pronouns,
mm-hmm.
you know, little things like that, all the way to we're going to fire you from your job, economic pressure. There's physical danger, mm-hmm. especially as the protesters showed up. And they're, you know, a lot of them have guns, like and it's legal for them to have guns. They're not shooting people, but there they are. And they're yelling and cursing, and your family is walking right by them. So they don't just try to manipulate you via fear as a man, but they try to manipulate you via the fear of your wife, children.
Right.
And so it is easy for a man to say, wouldn't it be easier, even if let's just take a few weeks off. Let's just go to a different church for a few weeks. But I really believe that one of the besetting sins of conservatives is cowardice. That we just... And it makes sense why it would be, because the left, their religion is Marxist political utopianism. And our religion is the worship of the Lord Jesus, and politics is just one aspect of life that is under the kingship of Christ. But it's not for us a religion. We just want to be normal, mm-hmm. like have our kids, love our families, work our businesses. And so for us, like political engagement and all these things, they're even an inconvenience. So when you add in this... like they want to smash up what is normal and then build utopia from the pieces. When you add in just the like almost baseline, what's the word? Like the baseline realities governing the left from the right, it's so much easier often for the right to just be like, ah, leave me alone.
Yeah.
This is inconvenient. But then when you add in the fear element of it as well, I think there's just such a besetting tendency. So the sermon, the reason I believe that it was, you know, the Holy Spirit's leadership in our church giving this kind of, this is what this is, naming it, it was very helpful, because then you can know, well, if this is a test of nerve, then I know what it means to pass.
Right.
We'll be not backing down. If, you know, versus would it be wise for me to keep my family safe and just sort of disassociate from this church, as you know, or even just publicly, even if I privately am still in, but maybe I won't show my face for a few weeks or something, mm-hmm. like that. It was helpful to have that label.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought you served your people well. Jordan and I listened to it. We were going somewhere. I can't remember where it was. We had like a 30-minute drive, 45-minute drive there and back, something like that. So we listened, and I thought you served your people well. I thought it was pastoral to be prayerfully considered how you could serve your people to help them and equip them through this, and also anticipate what some of the objections would have been from your people or some of the fears or anxieties, and commend you for doing that. You did a great job. I'm going to tell you kind of like the three high water marks for me in that sermon, how it impacted me, and then we can just kind of work through it categorically. So there's three of them, and I'll shoot some questions. And then at the very end, I've just got a question of tactics, the tactics that, that you guys employ, because I think it really is misunderstood by some, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but there's some people that don't like you guys out there.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
I'm hearing this for the first time.
Yeah, sorry to break the news to you, man. So let's work through these. I'll mention them. Number one, Twitter. Number two, the tactic of the enemy to get to our wives to say, hey, listen, instead of come back with your shield or on it, it's just pipe down about this, that, or the other thing. And then the third thing, battles unfought will end up being fought by your children, along with the battles that have been assigned to them in their generation. So I want to go through those three, explain why they were impactful or why I think they're helpful, and then just kind of see you banter back and forth about it. So number one, Twitter, you'd said in that sermon that, you know, what if you universalize the principle? It's kind of like a Luddite position where Twitter's stupid, it's gay, it's retarded, it's, you didn't use those words, but you could have. That's kind of been my posture, my position to Twitter and just online. I've been off Facebook and Twitter for several years now. It's been, honestly, I've kind of enjoyed not being there. But one of the things you'd said is that if we all walk away from cultural shaping institutions like Twitter that guide so much the conversation at large, but then that culture is brought down into even local small communities throughout the Midwest, all over the place, that it's cultural shape, it shapes, it's got power to move people. What if you universalize that principle and walk away from everything? And one of the things that's been so awful about evangelicalism for the last however many years has been walking away from civic power, walking away and just putting it in the hands of others who are wicked and evil, and we see what they do with it. And it is totalitarianism. It is their version of postmillennialism. They're coming after our kids, our grandkids, everybody else's kids, kind of thing. So I got to thinking, I got off Facebook a few years ago because we had a run-in with city councilman. He said some terrible things about me and tagged me. We've got red flag laws in Illinois. And so I jumped off Facebook, and then I just got off Twitter as well. So I'm hearing your sermon, and I'm thinking, you know what? I think, and I actually approached my wife, approached my pastors as well, said, guys, I think I'm going to get back on the internet because of this sermon. So I tease that out a little bit. Why do you think the social media, Twitter, is important? And explain it in greater detail than I just did about why it's important for Christians to be in those sort of spaces, declaring the truth and doing what God would have us in those corners of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, the temptation for conservatives is because we just want to be left alone and be normal and raise our family and worship our God. We don't want to have to argue with pink-haired leftists and, you know, about what a woman is. It's such an inconvenience. And so we tend to have an attitude of retreat. But what can happen is you can think like, okay, let's take a church or pastors, you know, people like me who are engaged pretty heavily in the culture war, in the political sphere-ish, great questions of morality, politics, ethics, life, beauty, goodness, all these things in the public sphere. It's really easy for people to go eventually to make a conclusion like, it's all fake, it's all stupid, it's just online warring, it's super inconvenient, it just brings conflict into my life. When you do engage in these fights, you get enemies, and your enemies want to make you look stupid. They will lie about you. I've had people in the last year make false accusations of me that I was a sexual predator, that I was secretly engaged in a double life involving multiple pornography accounts and things like that. And they were all spurious. But several large accounts, there was one point where hundreds of thousands of people were viewing materials baselessly accusing me of these things.
Wow.
And so that's what your enemies will do if you engage in these fights. And they'll also try to make you look unhip, uncool, unloving, etc. And so it's easy to just think like, well, why don't I just go to a church that's not engaged in those fights?
Mm-hmm.
Can't we just like do expository preaching? Yeah, apply it to the day, but like avoid the political, avoid the controversial subjects of the day. You know, why be on social media? It's just the internet. It's all fake. But the reality, the question I wanted to ask my people is universalize it. If every church was like that, if every Christian did that, then what we're actually doing is we're giving way before the wicked. We're like the muddied spring or polluted fountain of Proverbs 25, the righteous man giving way before the wicked. We're not doing what Paul said in Ephesians 5:11, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but expose them.
Right.
For these are the mediating cultural institutions that are shaping thoughts, hearts, lives of people today. They're discipling people. We abandon them, or if we take this kind of Luddite, I'm going to hide, it's inconvenient, it's a waste of time, it makes me anxious, then we're actually just saying to the pagans here, you have these.
Right.
So for the same reason that we started a school here, for the same reason that we do, you know, New Christendom Press as a publishing house, we actually want to go and say, those are not, you're not going to win those things unfought.
Yeah.
And I've asked people before in our church, you know, when they say, why are you guys involved in this? I get it. Like, I really do. It's inconvenient. Like,
yeah,
the Gospel Coalition would still be this one of the dominating voices of the Reformed world if not for Twitter warriors making fun of them.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
So,
yeah, man. It's interesting, you know, looking back at our history because, you know, I think it was maybe 8 or 9 years ago at this point that we were in Sojourn together. And, you know, I tracked you down. I still remember tracking you down, and it was about your reading list. I was wanting to ask you, you know, practically, how you working through so many books and all that. And it's funny to think about us being where Mike Cosper is and in a network with Mike Cosper. And then also with, what's his name? He was down with Joel. He was Colin Hansen. Colin Hansen also was in Sojourn as well during that time. And it's just funny how time changes, man. You look back and you realize, like, my goodness, I think the world has changed. We've changed. I've changed. And, you know, I think as Spurgeon said it, you know, there are certain people who have asked me, like, you know, Jared, what are the ways that you've changed over the years? And it's like, man, theologically, I don't think really I've changed a whole lot. I think it's you grow into a theology that was richer than you realized. And it really isn't shifting or changing. You know, look back. It's like, you know, creedally, I'd look back and say, you know, I'm pretty similar to where I've always been. But there's a growth in. And when people, through changing times, don't actually grow in depth theologically and you stay the exact same, what you end up being is this archaic old model of, it's archaic only by a few years, but you end up being the Gospel Coalition that's still making your same old arguments and getting, you know, one or two likes on your posts that you make. And so, you know, I think you would probably say the same. There's certainly theological changes to some degree or another, but largely it's just growing in depth and understanding of your theological tradition and just growing in. That's required through the difficulties that we faced in the last several years. And I think honestly, Brian, like the divides we're seeing now are largely between those who see the catastrophic way that we're going with mass immigration and those who don't.
Yeah.
And some of the implications down the road, you know, those who recognize that if we don't return to an Anglo-Protestant order, then we're doomed. And if we don't send out everybody who won't adapt and culturally assimilate into that, then we're in major, major trouble. There's those that recognize that. And then those on the other side that think only a Nazi could say that. You know,
exactly.
there's only a Nazi that could say that. And there's no other types of people that can say that sort of thing. So there are people that still don't understand the battles that we're facing, which is, I think, what leads some men to say, well, hey, you know, Brian, Ogden, others that are out there doing this cultural warfare stuff, there's other battles that you can fight that don't get you in as much trouble.
Yeah.
There's other things that you can say. There's a lot of pastors on Twitter. There's a lot of people on Twitter that aren't getting in trouble, that are just flying under the radar, enjoying it. And simultaneously, then, this charge that you gave to the wives, for those that are beginning to poke the bear, that are beginning to say things that are bringing truth and exposing darkness, it's rational to some degree to say, well, wait a second. Don't say that. Don't go there. Because if you go there and you say that, you're going to bring a lot of heat.
Yep.
So explain, come back with your shield and on it, the type of women that's needed for the men that see the times that we're living in and need to do something about it and want to do something about it and the potential cost there. What's needed from Christian women?
Yeah, I mean, we need Christian women who actually believe that their households exist for something far greater than the mere safety and comfort of their households. One of the tendencies of women, which is a design tendency, it's actually a good thing, is to be a nurturer. It's, you know, you want places of safety, of warmth, of peace, of joy. That's a good thing. A homemaker should be building that kind of environment around her where she's a self-controlled woman with a gentle and quiet spirit who honors and respects her husband and loves her children in Titus 2. But a mistake that a woman can make in her orientation to her husband is to misunderstand how the hierarchy and headship in the house works, where she actually neglects to realize that her husband exists to make their household oriented to something bigger than her and to the household itself. So his mission, he is to nourish and cherish her and lay his life down for her, but she's not actually the mission. Household exists for this great cosmic mission of really going out into the world God made and bringing order and peace from chaos, confronting evil and going to wild. Like whether your corner of creation is a one-bedroom apartment or you have a Christian duty to orient your household for the earthly and heavenly good of more than just your household, of your people, mm-hmm. your nation. And so a husband sometimes has to remind his wife, I actually have duties that might put me in danger or duties that will bring inconvenience on our household. And so he needs a wife who will say, I believe in what you're doing. I believe in the battles that you're fighting. I believe our household exists to be a troubler of darkness and not merely on the defensive or the retreat all the time. And so I'm going to have your back. And I want you to go and say the true thing in a timely way, in a wise way. I want you to do that for the sake of the world that we're making for our children and for our neighbor and for the glory of God. And so she kind of needs to orient her desire for peace and safety properly to the overall mission of the household and then honor and support her husband in pursuit of sometimes even risky obedience to the Lord when it comes to these things.
Very good. The battles unfought, thinking about battles unfought and future generations having to fight those. So a man hears that and recognizes, not just in my life, but in the world, I'm going to have to stand for the truth and I'm going to have to pursue building in the world, not just building a household, but building a household simultaneously going out and bringing the kingdom of God order and pushing back darkness, exposing darkness and bringing truth and real leadership and courage into situations that are going to cost me, that are going to cost possibly our family. That's going to be, okay, so you're there. There's a guy there. Battles unfought. So here's the third thing that really got me during that talk. Recently, the same city councilman that I had a run-in with, basically we had three murder mills that came into town. We're pleading with the city council, me and several other pastors are there. And I get up and have my 4 minutes and talk. And the city councilman said a bunch of horrible things about us all, you know, standard stuff, you're Christian jihadists and all these kinds of things. And then runs up on Facebook and all of this. And at the time, in my mind, and I still don't know, I was never actually scared of this man. I thought maybe he could get some red flag laws, like I mentioned before. And in Illinois, you can go and take somebody's guns with probable cause and that kind of thing. And really, I just didn't want to deal with this guy on the internet. He had tagged me on Facebook and a bunch of stuff. And I just got off the internet. Fast forward like 3 years. I just got off Facebook anyways. Fast forward like 3 years. And this guy just had another run-in and made the news. He was like flipping people off during the city council meeting and saying terrible things to another group of people. And it got me thinking, now, wait a minute. If I would have went back to the next city council meeting, and if my approach and tactic was not different, because I still haven't stopped fighting against the murder mills, what he did has not made me to stop doing things actually physically, like in physical reality. Our churches, we got a full-time evangelist out there. We've been doing a lot of work there. But what if I would have went back and confronted this man and talked to the mayor and the rest of the city councilmen and said, you know, is this appropriate behavior for people and your citizens in your community to be able to receive this from somebody that's an elected official, and fought, would that have stopped this latest round of people getting mistreated by this guy? And it just got me thinking, like, what if that's a micro example of unfought battles? And then the other piece to this is that during this murder mill thing and that video that I'd done, there were several outlets, news media outlets that reached out that need not be named, but were pretty like big news media outlets wanting to run articles about small town America with these abortion clinics coming because Roe v. Wade's overturned. And they had reached out to me multiple times asking for an interview. And I thought about it, prayed about it, talked to my elders about it. I talked to my wife and everybody's like, yeah, do whatever you want, you know, whatever. And just left it all in my court. And I was just kind of getting some counsel for them. I decided not to. And I thought, you know, I don't want the kind of heat that could bring if I do this article. And I'm hearing the sermon and I'm thinking, you know what? I don't think that was the right approach. I think I probably should have done that. So let's just talk about, it's a big, huge rant monologue here. Unfought battles will also be will end up being fought by our children, along with the battles that God has assigned for them in their generation. So why is it critical for us to fight now when the battle is on our doorstep?
Yeah, I really like that example. And it is, there's some tactics here. It's not, you know, everybody doesn't have to fight every battle, but we have to recognize, I think, two things. One, part of our job is to equip our children to fight battles. Like, part of the job of Christians is to occasionally start a riot, and it's to go sometimes be accused of turning the world upside down and be reviled and hated, and they crucified the Lord. So we should be acting in a way that at least we have a chance to occasionally be reviled and called names for Jesus' sake.
I mean, we are promised that would happen.
Yeah, like Jesus said. So knowing that we're to raise our children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord means one of the things that we're teaching them is how to fight battles. But number two, we don't want the battles that they have to fight be battles that God appointed for them because of the cowardice of their fathers.
Yeah. Ouch, man.
And God was like, hey, in Providence, son, you get to fight this battle that your dad, I gave him the invitation.
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. Or mom and dad, and like not just dad, but like Christians. So I want our kids to be able to fight battles and look to us as models and say, I'm going to fight this battle the way my dad fought his battles, instead of going, because so much of the intergenerational strife right now, like where you say millennials are mad at baby boomers and, you know, Gen Z is going to be mad at millennials probably. Some of it is illegitimate, but some of it's legitimate. Mm-hmm. Where you say, baby boomers, you embraced all of the, or you gave way far too easily before the globalistic scourge and before the sexual revolution and before the you know, all these different things. You gave way before them. And what, a couple hippie protesters marched and you gave up? Like, yeah. Come on. What? Now we have to fight them. And the nature of unfought battles is that they don't get better and they don't even stay the same. They get worse.
Yeah.
So if I should have fought a 9-foot-tall giant, my kids, and I leave him alone, he's going to be 15 feet tall by the time my kids have to fight him. 3 feet tall.
Yeah.
So there's just this dynamic that often drives us here in Ogden to think, yeah, it's an uphill battle. A lot of this stuff's tough. I don't want to have to, believe it or not, I actually don't want to have to talk about racial tensions. And I don't want to have to talk about endless sexual deviancy. I would much rather just like love my wife, preach through books of the Bible and call it good, you know, like mm-hmm. But I don't want to leave these things to my kids 10 yeah. times worse.
Right. Well, and I think, again, there's a divide of people who recognize the state that we are in and what is coming, and those who don't and think that things are the way they are and it's normal and it's this is just how things are. They don't recognize the consequence of ideas down the road. I think for me, you know, in thinking through, do I take these interviews or not? Do I face this guy publicly or just get off the internet? And I think now, and just thinking through, it's like there is this internal wisdom. Well, it almost sounds wise. Well, you know what? It's true that every battle doesn't need to be fought. Okay. There's wisdom and prudence applied in how you fight and what you fight, what battles you face that are yours to face, assigned to you by God. And then what is just stirring up trouble to stir up trouble's sake. That kind of, that, you know, elder is not to be quarrelsome. So there's that category that I've got to think through as well as an elder. But, you know, Brian, you can convince yourself. And I think this is what I did, and looking back and just kind of reflecting after hearing your sermon, it's like, you know, I think it was just this, well, I do want to protect my family, and I do, and I, you do that long enough, whereas I just want to protect my family. I just want to protect my family. I don't want to cause a bunch of people to turn or attention to turn to me. I don't want to bring unnecessary attention. And eventually you've got Muslims at your front door.
Yeah.
You know, eventually they're at the gates and you just have to do something. And so anyways, it was a holy kind of cattle prodding to help me think through, you know, what is proper engagement for me personally in this community and based on what we have faced and what would have been maybe a more appropriate response even 2 years ago. And now moving forward, how am I to respond if something like that happens again? And so I just commend you. I think it was helpful, and I think it was important. Let me switch gears one more time and just put you on the hot seat, because our friendship, whether you know it or not, I love you guys, appreciate you guys, but just being your friend sometimes has brought in heat to me. And sure. I have stood by you. I'm loyal to you as a friend. I'm not going to speak negative about you. And, you know, if you do something that I think is stupid, well, then I wouldn't hesitate to call you. In fact, I've talked to you guys a couple times about some things, just asking questions and giving some pushback. But I appreciate you and learned a lot from you. But there's a big crowd of people who say, well, why do you have to talk about Black culture? Why do you talk about feminism so much? Why do you have to talk about modesty? And why do you have to, you know, the internet, what I've recognized about Twitter is that it's locker room talk made public. I mean, this is what people don't understand, is that it's just a lot of guys would banter back and forth, and then the ladies who dare enter in kind of thing. But one of the things, it's my Bible reading this morning, and I know you're good with hot seat questions. Mm-hmm. And so I want to just read a verse, and I want you to explain how you think through that and what's different with what you guys are doing, which sometimes you'll poke the bear. I mean, you posted the Black culture thing. You didn't say anything that Larry Elder hasn't said, that Thomas Sowell hasn't said, that Jesse Lee Peterson haven't said, that even like Matt Walsh or Ben Shapiro haven't said or hasn't said. But you guys said it, and the internet blows up. Okay? So here's what it says. And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring, correcting his opponents with gentleness. God may perhaps grant repentance leading to a knowledge of the truth. And here's what I think would be helpful is just thinking through that. People accuse you guys. You guys are just rebel rousers, you know, quarrelsome, this kind of thing. What's the strategy behind why Ogden does what it does?
Yeah. Yeah. And we have, so that verse is very much on my mind a lot. The other, you know, other passages like where Paul says, let your reasonableness be known to all men. He talks about not correcting an older man as you would a younger man. So there's lots of guardrails around our speech that we have to keep in mind. And I'm also at the same time trying to understand how those commands are friends and not enemies with both examples that we see in the Old and New Testament of the Lord and the apostles being quite bold and confrontational with their enemies, insulting them, mocking them. You know, and I think it really comes back to kind of that wisdom required to understand the pair of Proverbs on answering a fool according to his folly, but also not answering a fool according to his folly. Or is this, don't answer a fool according to his folly, you know, and then, but also do answer a fool according to his folly, lest he become wise in his own eyes. A lot of this, it requires us to understand in a situation how to respond, in which mode, and what tool in my rhetorical tool belt am I going to pick up? So when I think about a quarrelsome man, one thing that the place that I think you should start to test whether, for example, Pastor Brian Sauve is quarrelsome is survey my church, survey my family, friends, elder team. And if someone comes and brings a concern, or do I listen to them? Do I, you know, engage them with complete patience and teaching as Paul urges the elder to do? Am I known as someone who's just hot-headed and brash? Am I constantly interrupting and insulting people? You know, is there like a domineering, swaggering tone to how I'm engaging with them? And if most of the people in my life would say, and I think they would say, no, I actually annoy my wife pretty frequently because I really want to steel man my opponents. And so we'll be talking sometimes and she'll say something and I'll be like, well, that person, that opponent, they don't actually think that. They think this. And then, you know, I'll steel man their position. And I do try to engage in that way. Mm-hmm. But then there are also places like in public speech where I would view these as more prophetic modes of speech, where the goal is to more it be an Elijah kind of mode where I'm poking the gods of the age in both eye, where you are answering the fool according to his folly, where you are being quite bold and confrontational. And on that front, I think it would be foolish to try to claim infallibility. And I'm sure someone could point to examples where I've fallen short of that. No question. I'm sure they could. Even in my own life in the elder team, I can think of concrete examples, not just in the distant past, but like concrete examples in the last year where an elder at the church, one of our elders said, Brian, you know, you read these three paragraphs in this book. And then they go, and I say, that's really bad. They go, that's you. And then I'm like, oh,
you're the man.
I just did that thing that was really stupid or unhelpful or bad leadership or, you know, so none of us are infallible. We're always going to, and we're going to have tendencies to sin. Some of it's going to be in the direction of cowardice and mealy-mouth softness. And some of us are going to have a tendency to sin in hotheadedness and brashness. And what we need is that, you know, magical, just being a Christian where we're open to correction. Somebody can bring something that I said and say, I think you were wrong here, or you said this in the wrong way. And that's fair. I have repented of saying things before because of that. But in general, my rule is that I won't say anything on a podcast or in social media that I wouldn't be willing to defend from the pulpit of my church if needed. And I live by that rule. So you usually even take the Black culture clip that went viral. First of all, I can't predict what thing is going to go viral. I say 10 things a day that if they got in front of the wrong group would make it on CNN, you know, like any episode of the King's Hall or something. So that was like, I didn't know that was going to go viral outside of our general audience. And it did. But I've listened to it many times since then and critically analyzed it and talked at length. And I would defend every proposition that I made. And I made them all having thought about them extensively beforehand. I even had sent part of this and said, you know, to some elders in the church, like, I think this is true. I think it would be timely in light of this situation. What do you think?
Yeah.
And like, no, I think that's true and timely, and that's go ahead. So people can sometimes get the impression that what we're trying to do is just cause outrage for the sake of attention. But what we're actually trying to do is speak the truth into precisely those areas of society that desperately need somebody to come in and say, what you're doing here is wildly sinful, civilization destroying, and unless you stop, people are going to die and go to hell. Yeah. So you should stop. And then here's the hope of the gospel.
Well, here's the thing. I think of the people that raged, and there was a lot of people that raged at a clip like that. There is a small percentage. There's a young Black guy out there that watches that video, and the Holy Spirit begins to work. And you'll never hear about this, probably. But in that moment, he realizes he's right. That's right. That's true. And those are the testimonial side of things, that we don't know exactly what the Holy Spirit's doing. But when there's truth and it's going out and it's being heard, there's always going to be people who rage about it. But then there's going to be this collection of people over here on the other side that are like, that was my moment that God got a hold of me and grip me and help me to see, yes, that is the sin, that the cultural sins that I have been walking in, exactly what's being described right there. And, you know, I'm praying that things like that happen in our ministry as well. And, you know, you'll never hear about that kind of thing. There's going to be some old dude in 30, 40 years, and his testimony is going to be, you know, I heard this clip years ago, and that's when God got a hold of me. And while all these other people are raging. So, okay, so to summarize all that, it's just like a time to hate. Your sermon I preached, I hate them with complete hatred. And that was my sermon title. And, you know, it went through the Psalms that Jesus sang. And yet he's the one that also said, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And how these things aren't at odds. They complement, they don't contradict. So how do you apply these things then in practical ways? And in the same way, then the text I just read, along with the pastoral examples that we have in the New Testament, provide us with not contradictory accounts, but it leads us to walk in wisdom with how these things are applied and, you know, live in some sort of pastoral tension that I've got to have, you know, appropriateness and kindness. And yet there's a time to turn over tables, and there's a time, and examples we have of Jesus himself, where the tone police would have called him out like crazy. So walking that line. Okay, let's do one more. And this is just what I've been thinking through personally, talking to, it's one thing to poke the bear of cultural idols from the non-Christian world, but then Christian community together, okay, without any names or anything like that, of people that me and my elder team, we'll make fun of behind the scenes. Like, can you believe that take? That's the literally the dumbest thing. What an idiot, you know, kind of rhetoric. But still yet, I was just talking to Andy, one of my co-pastors. It's like, you know, there's some guys that, well, I will throw out a name, like Owen Strand, for instance, that I think he is about as goofy as it gets, but I do believe he's a Christian brother. Okay, I believe that seems to be the case. When it comes to internet back and forth with Christian brothers, how are we to conduct ourselves, and how do these kinds of examples that Jesus gives, or this text that I just read, how do we apply those in a way that's faithful and yet still say that's a terrible take, that's stupid, without, you know, there's a line to walk. Sometimes we're going to get it wrong. But what's the tactic of talking to other Christian brothers that may have a terrible take on something, and how do we call them out in a way that's helpful and biblically faithful?
Yeah. And again, this is like, and it's a good question. It's a difficult thing to figure out. One of the things that makes it difficult is that you don't get to choose who is going to say what about you. So a lot of the time, like Owen is a good example of someone who years ago was in all of our inboxes, you know, hey, I love your content, Eric, me, good job. And then a year or two later is routinely like, I think he's counter signaling me. And then from that to just overt, like, these guys are, they're terrible. And some, you know, all the way up to and including not Christians, false teachers. I've heard quite a bit. And so you do have this dynamic where sometimes you don't get to choose. People can neglect to realize that a lot of our conflict within Christian circles, at least I'm speaking for the King's Hall, New Christian Press, Ogden, very little of it are things that we have instigated. We actually try not to instigate intramural conflict that frequently with other people, partly because of what you're talking about. It's a different thing to be at odds with your brother than it is to go and wage war with the idols of the day. Generally, like the unity of the body is one of the most frequently exhorted virtues for the church to pursue, is Christian unity, even across great disagreement. So we do need to have that category. I do think that it can be fair. Like, we have a positive duty in the Ninth Commandment to defend your good name. And so sometimes that requires engaging other people who they're at least publicly Christians. And I don't have reason to doubt necessarily they're like not Christians or something like that. They disagree with us on different things. And there, I do think that it is important. It's difficult to keep that category steady and clean and treat them Christian. I think this is one thing in the discourse that's actually probably one of the worst aspects of online Christian discourse, is the way that we can tend to treat one another. And so on that, I think that there's probably conviction for everybody. Mm-hmm. They look back at all the words and say, yeah, I was actually heated in that point.
Right.
And I wasn't treating them as a Christian. And at the same time saying, but sometimes you don't pick every fight that you have. If someone insists on being in a fight with you and making very public claims about you, then you do have to answer them at some point.
Of course. Yeah. What I appreciate about you guys, and I think some people don't know this about you, and just knowing you and the guys out there, you guys have a very calculated plan moving forward. You're not slipshod. You know, as some people would say, well, you're not shock jocks. You've got a very specific plan of what you guys, Lord willing, are trying to accomplish. And I really appreciate that about you guys. And then you get after it. And you know, listening in to just the camaraderie and the friendship that is going on, and just the loyalty of brotherhood out there, I think a lot of the accusers actually long for some of the community and the relationships and the depth of friendships that you guys have. And a part of the anger and hostility, it's kind of like people are angry at the patriarchy really because they're angry at their dad for either not being there, or they're really bitter and jealous of those who have a really good dad. So they're just longing for it. And I think what you guys have, there's a watching world that also longs for what you have, because I think what you guys have going on is really, you know, amazing thing. Let me ask you this, moving forward. There is, in the conservative pundit world, the so-called conservative pundit world, there is divisions, you know, from Charlie Kirk's death forward. Are we Israel first? Are we America first? What are we doing here with all this immigration? When are we going to deport 100 million people? Are we ever going to? Is it ever going to happen, kind of thing? All these divisions that are happening. As far as the company of friends that are on the internet around the country that are 99% united theologically, how does the reform world come together long term? And what does it look like, you know, 10 years from now to not go the route that it seems like the conservative world and the political world is going? How do we move forward in a way where we're aligned, or at least we're standing in a foxhole together? We may not see everything exactly the same way, but how do we get more and more people in the same foxhole together fighting and then getting out of the foxhole and advancing together in the same way?
I think we have to maintain, there's one rigorous category that we have to maintain that we're not doing a good job of maintaining right now. And that is the distinction between heresy and disagreement.
Okay.
So when it comes to many of these issues, there are controversial subjects where there's a lot of disagreement. And the issue that I see is not that there are people who are saying like, okay, this person over here is saying this about whether it's race or sexed piety or any of the controversial subjects of the day, World War II history, whatever it is. I think that one of the errors we're making right now is turning many of those things into tests of orthodoxy, where unless you agree with me all the way down to the 10th decimal point, you're not even a brother in Christ.
Yeah, right.
We're going to bring you before the elder session. At our church, like I was just talking with a family that was visiting, thinking about moving here, and just had lunch with them. And they were like, tell me about the community. Like, what does everybody agree on stuff? Like, where's the, and I said, well, we don't agree on everything. But what we do have is we have a destigmatized culture of discussion where you can go and read that book that everybody says is, you know, terrible or should be banned, or listen to that podcast. And then we can talk about it and be like, yeah, I thought they were right about this. I thought it was wrong here. We disagree about this. But most of these things don't need to be a test of orthodoxy. Because if it's a test of orthodoxy, then I have a God-given duty to wage war with all of my soul against you infecting the church with your grievous mortal error.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a different category than, okay, we disagree about the extent of the permissibility of women from serving in political punditry. Can we still get along? I think so.
Yeah, I would hope so.
I think so. You know, like, can we disagree about the finer points of World War II history? FDR, Churchill, Hitler. Can we disagree about some of the finer points? Yeah, I think so. History's really complicated. Sure, that's fine. But when we turn them into a test of heresy versus basically whether you're in or out of the church, then, and what drives some of this is just rampant tribalism, where, you know, people say to me all the time, like, pick any controversy. And there is just a reality that when you have a big enough platform, you can say almost anything. And for tribal reasons, someone will find a way to be offended by what you just said. And so I had noticed, you know, I had said something on a pod, I can't even remember what it was. And someone, you know, wrote a dissertation, just a big piety dissertation about how they, you know, how I was in deep sin because of this thing. And I looked at it and I was like, am I looking at the same thing? I said like some mild joke about something or other.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was ironic because I know that the group that this person came from, their minister, like made their bread and butter on much more controversial jokes than I had just made.
Okay.
And yet if you search their page, you would find no such piety dissertations directed at their, mm-hmm. their thing. But because there was tribal disagreement between me and what I represent and their group and what they represent, they were looking at me with a jaundiced eye. And we can do this, where we start looking for reasons to be offended with our brother because we know that they're in this tribe and we're in this tribe.
Yeah.
That is, I think, tremendously counterproductive. We need powerful coalition if we're going to accomplish anything meaningful in America. And there is going to be no powerful coalition if we draw the circle of political or theological orthodoxy at our own feet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. My buddy, and I know you, Scott, you know Scott as well. My buddy, Scott Tanaka, used to talk about purity spirals all the time. And that sort of thing where people pick sides based on the finer points of patriarchy or even make eschatology their central point. You know, we did at our church a year ago, we have differing positions on our elder team when it comes to eschatology. And understanding the doctrines that you can make fun of each other and go back and forth with each other about, and not making those the dividing line of membership or coming to the table or fellowship, is critical. I think that's really important. And man, it's been fun. It's been great catching up, and we could keep going and talk about a whole lot of other things. But I'm thankful for you and your ministry and what you guys are doing out there. And, you know, I think it's for those that would listen in, and because I know that I'm going to have some Rage listeners listening in. So sorry to bring that up again, but I know I'll have some that will listen just to hear what we talked about, kind of thing. But I'm thankful for you as a Christian brother. I'm thankful for you. And, you know, you and Lexi have meant a lot to us. So, man, keep up the good work and, you know, pass the test of nerve and keep leading your people through that. And, you know, that's giving courage to other folks. And just like there's going to be some, you know, black dude in 30 years from now saying, you know, that was my moment after I heard that video. You know, there's other pastors like myself who have been encouraged and are built up. And so the impact that is happening through your work is going to be felt down through, you know, the generations. And so, man, keep it up, keep up the good work, and appreciate you making time to talk to me today.
Yeah. Thanks, brother. Likewise. I love you guys. Always encouraged, but to hear what you guys are up to, and just really, really appreciate you. And thanks for being persistent in texting me.
Yeah, I know, right? I got to send some memes every once in a while, you know, like, hey, douchebag, you know, write me back or something. Yeah.
I appreciate it. I, of all people, you know, you send me the rude meme and I'll take it well. Because it's all true.
Yeah, good deal. Well, guys, we've been talking to Brian Sauvé. Brian, appreciate it, man.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, brother.